Welcome to the Hero Cafe. My name is Sam Drake.
And I'm Cameron Bowes.
And this week we're going to talk to you about Deadpool 2. And there's not a lot of news, but we've got some pretty cool numbers coming out on Infinity War. And, of course, opening weekend numbers for Deadpool that we're going to talk about as well. Cameron, you ready to get started?
Ready.
Because we're dealing with summer blockbuster season, there's not a whole lot of, like, announcements that tend to come out this time of year. We have a little bit on casting or on stuff like this and that. Mostly the industry is just busy putting out films, and so right now the only news that we really have, other than little stuff here and there, is that Avengers Infinity War continues to do a lot of work. Let's see, we just wrapped up, it would have been our fourth weekend last weekend. We're recording on the 20th, and so far we've made almost, pretty much, it's $595, but it's $600 million domestically, $1.2 billion internationally, with a worldwide box office of $1.8 billion, puts it at number 3 behind Titanic at 2.2 and Avatar at 2.7. So it's in the race. I keep telling people it's going to be bigger than Titanic, and I think we can count on that. I'm kind of wondering whether it'll hit Avatar, though. I have a feeling Avengers 4 will, but this is Empire, and like I know this, when I say it's Empire, this is the downer film before we win the whole enchilada next time. And I already know that, like, people like my dad, like, went to go see this movie and was upset, and he can't be the only one who felt like they wasted money on this film. So I don't know, but Cameron, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I think there's no way it gets probably anywhere close to Titanic or Avatar. It would be interesting to see. It's actually number 4 of all time behind Star Wars: The Force Awakens. Star Wars: The Force Awakens has just a little over 2 billion altogether. The Force Awakens absolutely crushed domestically in its entire box office run. And being released in December, I think, had a lot to do with that. So it's a little over 200 mil shy. I don't think it's entirely impossible, but as we get deeper and deeper into the summer season, I'd say it's more and more unlikely. It overtook Jurassic World to be number 4 right now. Considering it is still early in its release, like you said, it's only about the fourth weekend in, and Black Panther has stayed in the top 10 for the last like 14 weeks or something like that, you know, so it's going to continue to climb, you know, and, we'll see how close it can get to that number 3 spot for sure. I'd say that's probably the highest it will go at the very, and that's best case scenario, I would imagine. But yeah, hopefully the excitement and everything that's kind of generated from this really pushes the second one even further. We'll see how that goes, of course. But I tell you right now, I mean, nobody at Marvel Studios is crying about this. So all great stuff. And Black Panther officially, I think, has exited theaters, and it ended at 1.3 billion, and it's the number 9 spot of all time, which is just pretty much crazy. Because outside of Avatar and Titanic, it's technically the only, like origin-style film. For example, it's above Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. So it's, like, the very end of a franchise there. Right above it is, you know, Age of Ultron, which is, again, a sequel. Fast and Furious 7, sequel. Marvel's The Avengers, which is a culminate. Obviously, it's a sequel in its own right. I mean, it's hard to say with the MCU, right? Because they're all kind of sequels to each other. But there was just so much, like, cultural significance and everything like that, that it's really pretty unique for that movie to be in the top 10, just with it being, again, the fact that it's kind of its own movie in that way, you know, that it's the origin movie and everything like that. So huge congrats to that movie too.
I'm still so happy that Black Panther did as well as it did. I think 1.3, like I said, anybody who cracks a billion worldwide, that's they're popping champagne on that, so no one's sad here, right? It's just the geeks who really, like, man, can't believe Titanic made more money than Avengers. That thing was a masterpiece, right? You know, that's just us. After that, other than that, we've just got opening weekend numbers on Deadpool 2. Deadpool 2 opened ahead of Avengers Infinity War. It was 125 to Deadpool and then 28 to Avengers Infinity War.
It should be said that Deadpool 2 opened a little underestimated numbers and below Deadpool 1. A lot of people are crediting Deadpool 1's first box office numbers to Holiday, but I think that's spinning it a little bit to me. It does say something that a sequel opens lower than its first movie. So that's interesting, you know? And maybe if Avengers Infinity War has something to do with that too. I mean, 28 mil in this fifth weekend or fourth weekend or whatever. That's a pretty big number. So it does prove, you know, exactly what we were kind of just talking about, that as you get into the summer season, in some ways, a lot of these movies are going to chip at each other. Going to happen when you have this many movies opening back to back to back. So like next week, Han Solo comes out, right? And we're going to see a huge, drop, not only for Deadpool, but for probably Avengers Infinity War as well, I imagine. So it's going to continue to affect every movie at this point coming out. And Deadpool, of course, will see the biggest drop because, you know, I imagine we're going to see over a 50% drop because of Han Solo for sure. So Star Wars just has that effect. So yeah, anyways, good opening, not spectacular though. So we'll see how it fares along the road.
I felt like there wasn't as much, just anecdotally in my circles, I felt like this was not as much of a must-see as Deadpool when it first came out. I don't know if part of that is novelty. I mean, there wasn't anything like Deadpool when it came out. We'll get into the movie itself, but these numbers to me, I don't know, it makes me, because I'm not an industry guy, right? I just go watch the movies and I enjoy them, but I kind of wonder why everyone loves to put out their movies at the same time as everyone else putting out their heavy hitter movies. I feel like there's got to be something to the idea that there's a lot more money flying around in general during the summer blockbuster season, but I feel like if you're going to go toe-to-toe in a cutthroat back and forth with every other studio over the same weekend, like, how much money are you really making if it's such a crowded market? You could say that that's what's driving people to go to February and March, months that don't have as much competition in them, to just own two or three weekends, right? Just say, this is ours.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what Infinity War did, right? Like, they seen that 1 week prior to their release, they were going to have Deadpool 2 basically as competition, and the week right after, they were going to have Han Solo right after that. So they did the smart thing, and they moved up, you know, what was it, 2 weekends, basically? And that's why they owned for 3 weekends in a row before now. So it was smart on their part. I'm sure they really wanted that May release date, just because there's a little bit of, like, when it comes to Marvel, they're a little sentimental about that date, just because it's been like that for a long time, and they want to be that opening season or kickoff and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, they definitely made the right choice there, I think. So, well, actually, it'll be interesting to see what happens next year, because they still have a May release date for then, right? And so it'll be interesting to see who piles up behind them, to see if that adjusts what they're going to do as well. Really, it's Captain Marvel that's in like the most perfect position, because they're in like April of next year, and that's another one of those like pretty dead zone months, unless you get some random heavy hitters in there. Like A Quiet Place did really well in April this last, you know, this year. So box office is always interesting. I feel like I'm learning more and more about it as I go on, and it's an art. It's a strange art to it. So
it is arcane and strange, yeah, and mysterious.
Yeah, it is.
Well, so with that, we'll move into our feature story, which of course is Deadpool 2. This is our spoilers warning. You know, it's our show. There's no reason to, if we don't want to do the whole spoiler-free synopsis and how we feel about it, that's just a lot of effort that I just don't really want to do. You ever get that feeling? You ever watch like spoiler-free reviews and people are like, so I'm not going to tell you about this part where he did this thing, but it really made the whole movie, and you're like, well, thanks a lot, buddy. This is a useless review to me.
Right. I mean, there's some reviews. I always kind of felt that way watching it. Like, I was so excited for the reviews for Avengers Infinity War that it didn't matter to me as much, but it's when it comes to superhero movies especially, so much of the plot that happens in these films end up being spoilery in some way, right? Because there's always some big inciting event or anything like that, which I think this whole movie is completely set up by a very big spoilery event, right? So it's hard to dance around, and it's kind of annoying, I think, for listeners and us just trying to do that. So I think for me, if you're looking for a spoiler-free recommendation, you have it. Go see the movie. It's hilarious. But other than that, as far as getting into specifics, it's better if you just come back after you watch the movie to listen to this. So
you have been warned. All right. Deadpool 2 picks up pretty much right where we left off at the end of Deadpool, right?
Yeah, I mean, very short amount of time after, you know. It's never, of course, really said, but yeah, fair to say. Happens pretty closely to the events of the first movie. Yeah, and it kind of just... It's the movie. I mean, the movie starts with, you know, Deadpool basically committing suicide, and you don't really know why. And then, just like the first movie, he takes you back in time and kind of shows you the events leading up to this point, right? Instead of a highway scene, it's him committing suicide. Like, it's the same basic concept. They directly pull that from the first movie. Because audience are kind of used to it at this point, right? So that kind of makes sense. But basically, all these, you know, that has a great fight scenes kind of in the beginning. He's cleaning up the streets, right? Like, he's kind of being heroic and stuff like this. But basically, at the end of the day, all of this leads up to the inciting incident for him to commit suicide, right? Which is Vanessa dying, which is kind of the moment there at the beginning I was talking about. Like, this whole movie seems very much, this is the springboarding moment for the entire movie. More than anything else, it affects the movie completely from beginning to end. Vanessa is killed basically in an ambush for Deadpool after he goes on these killing rampages, cleaning up the streets. You know, somebody doesn't take too kindly to that and directly ends up killing her by somewhat accident, right? Like, they're after him, but she dies as a result. And so from this point forward, it kind of springboards into the fact that he's lost. You know, it's a lot of the movie is he feels very without direction, which is kind of interesting, just in a way that the movie at some points feels that way too. You know, it just seems like scenes kind of cut together. But at the end, like, they're all funny, and so it's easier to forgive for a lot of people. For some people, it hasn't been. But yeah, I mean, that's, and I think that for me, that if we're going to talk about what we like and what we don't like, what I do like is that remaining thread of Vanessa and Deadpool are the heart of what this movie franchise is. The first one relied so much on their relationship, right? To me, it only makes sense that it, that carry over to the second one. And I think it does. I'll be honest, like, going into the movie, I didn't expect her to die. So I was surprised in that way that she was going to die, especially as early on as she did, for that to be the inciting incident. And so I was like, okay, interesting. You know, I was like, that's that kind of, you know, you're kind of like, oh man, that kind of sucks. Like, she was great in the first movie. Hopefully it doesn't have that missing heartbeat. And luckily it doesn't, because her presence is still felt, not only visually, because she comes back in a lot of ways with the idea that, you know, he continues to visit her whenever he dies, you know, but gets resurrected. And it's kind of like a spiritual journey for Deadpool, trying to figure out how he can get to her. As they say in the movie, his heart's not in the right place, so he has to find out what that means, you know. And I thought that was very good. And going with somebody who's kind of more, I went with two people my second time, that's very much more general audience, I would say. And I can, you know, I always kind of look to people like them to see how something works in a movie. And they were both fighting back tears pretty well by the end of the movie, because the movie definitely has that, pulls on the heartstrings a little bit with them by the end. Even for me, I noticed that, you know, the first time was rough. But then seeing again with them, like, they've kind of felt the same way watching it when I went the second time. And so I think what they were trying to accomplish there works really well. I think that's a big strong point of the movie, is that Deadpool Vanessa relationship is still very, very strong and relevant for the second movie, despite Vanessa not really having the screen time, I guess you could say, as she did in the first one, right? She's not a main character, but it works well. And so the heart is still there, as well as the jokes, right? The jokes are hilarious, as all comedies, even the first movie. Not every joke lands by any means, but that's because they're throwing 100 of them at you, like,
right, the volume approach to comedy.
yeah, exactly. There are some extremely, extremely funny moments in the movie, and so the jokes are a plus, you know, in the movie and everything like that. And then you have the whole X-Force element, whether it's Cable, whether it's Domino, whether it's all the other people in there. Peter, of course. Peter was a huge standout from the trailers that everybody was really looking forward to in the movie. Even just from our conversation, that was the thing that finally made me laugh, right? That last trailer of Peter was the one that really sold me on the movie. I was like, okay, I can't wait to see this. And so you have all those elements in there. And for a lot of it, you know, a lot of those elements work too. But so I think we'll kind of get into that here in just a little bit. What about you, Sam? Is there anything specific in the movie that you really loved about it or anything like that? Like, what are your kind of thoughts about the movie?
Yeah, so part of what we, because I went to go see it with my wife, because this is kind of up her alley, loves the whole idea of Deadpool in the superhero space, someone who doesn't really take this super seriously and kind of does its own thing, right? So to gear up, we watched the first one like the night before, and then the next night we went out to go see it. Best practices, always a good idea for any movie that you go to, just watch the first one the next day before you go. Part of what I noticed was that the opening montage didn't really grab me as immediately fascinating like the highway scene did in Deadpool 1. It had this, like, there's so many layers of stuff that was happening in the highway scene. And, like, every time you see something, you're like, wow, that's something. Whoa, that's something, right? You know, he zooms out and he's grabbing the guy by his underwear as the whole thing is flipping over, right? You know, it just gets more and more absurd. And it was really perfectly timed and really perfectly composed. And I think, like, part of that, I feel like a running theme for me is going to be that, like, Deadpool 1 had kind of a garage band feel to it that happens when you have a $2 budget. And you're told to just make it, you know, stretch it as far as you can. And you get really creative people doing everything they can, right? This is a dynamic that we talk about on this show, this whole idea that restrictions cause creative effort. And a lot of times, the smaller your budget is, the harder you're making people work. You know, maybe it's not super fun, but the effort shows through, right? And I think they had more to work with on this film. And so they kind of, I think you lost a little bit of that. A little bit of that, what's the word here? A little bit of that fight, or like that grab it and make it happen kind of feel to it. Which doesn't break my heart, right? I think there's no way. You basically have to tell people, hey, you made this super successful movie. We're going to give you nothing to make the second sequel. Because we don't like spending money on guaranteed money, right? Like this was going to happen. So the blow up the apartment montage didn't kind of grab me like the highway scene did. But it didn't necessarily need to. Right? You know, I'd seen Deadpool 1. I was in a theater to see this one. I was pretty sure I was going to enjoy it. So it didn't break my heart. But I did notice it. The other part that I noticed was that, see, I had my idea and then I lost it. That was kind of my main thing. It wasn't just immediately like, what's going on here? How did he end up here? Right? I think the scene, the part of the movie where he's moping around, to me felt like a lot of waste of time. You know, like in the first film, he's moping around, but he's also, like, there's a purpose behind the moping, right? He's got a mission, right? In this one, he's just, like, lounging around, making the same joke he made last film about how X-Mansion always seems to have, like, three people in it the entire time, right? So it was, like, I really could have... It felt like a waste of time. Compared to the rest of the movie, which is done really well, you could probably have condensed all that down into, like, a 30-second thing. You know, that's the end of my complaining. I don't know. People who complain about movies that they went to go see and enjoyed bug the crap out of me. That's just my deal, right? It's just like, yeah, they should have done this, and this was garbage, and I hated this. 7 out of 10. And I'm like, what are you doing? You know. So I'm going to try really hard to do that, because I try to be the change that I see in the world. But I don't know. I kind of wanted just a little bit more, but the rest of the film worked well enough for me that I'm kind of like, yeah, whatever.
I mean, I'm kind of with you there. Like, the as much as I love seeing Negasonic Teenage Warhead and Colossus and everything like that, right, like, it just felt weird. Like, yeah. I don't know. It was just, and, you know, I love the cameos of the X-Men and everything. Like, you know, like, there's moments in there again. And it's like, that's where I was kind of talking about, like, it seems like it jumps from scene to scene a little bit, kind of lost in direction. But again, those scenes are fun in their own way, you know, but as far as just like a cohesive story, like, it feels a little loose, right? Like, it doesn't feel as, like, the first film was very tightly knit, mostly because it had to be, again, because of those restrictions you were just talking about. And again, it's like, there is relevance to the scene, just because you, of course, barely would have Colossus any introduction to that whole aspect of the ending without that little section. But again, it's just the pacing, I guess, of it was just very strange, right? Like, because he's moping around in the bar beforehand,
which is much more Wade's style, right? Like, we get real, he's the guy who handles his problem with Fireball, not with, you know, bunny slippers.
Exactly. Yeah. And then he mopes around some more in the mansion after he commits suicide when Colossus finds him and stuff like that, right? Like, at the end, like, again, the scene was funny, like, it had its moments and stuff like that. And but yeah, it's not until really we get to the scene where he becomes the X-Men trainee that things really start to, like, which is the next scene. So again, it's like, it's just really not a whole lot to complain about when it comes to that opening little segment there in the mansion. Cause again, you kind of need it to get to this point too. It is what it is. But, you know, that's, I thought all of that was very funny and very well done. You know, it's the introduction of Russell. You know, it seemed a little strange, you know, on how he gets arrested too with Russell. I don't know, that was weird. You know, it just felt like they had to find a way to get Deadpool and Russell into the prison together. And so that's what they came up with, you know, like, I felt like there could have been something. And again, I'm not good at this, right? Like, I don't know how they would have done it better, but it feels like there was a way. It just felt kind of clunky in that way too. Again, that scene had some really funny moments with the whole, like, everybody referring, you know, he's already committed to being like the X-Men, and like, they're like trainee, you know, like, I love that. Like, everybody's just like constantly harping on him for being the trainee and stuff like that. Like, all of that was great. And you have that camaraderie that you kind of carry over again from the first movie with Colossus and Negasonic and everything like that. So yeah. And then you kind of just get, you know, little hints of how Russell's powers and stuff like that. So and Essex, of course, is another big character kind of drop. Essex House for mutants and stuff like that. That's a Mr. Sinister reference that they also had in the post-credit scene for X-Men Apocalypse. So they're subtly continuing to drop those hints to Essex and Mr. Sinister. So when they plan on bringing him in, it's got to be sometime soon if they keep dropping these hints. But and then it's, of course, like right around this time, too, that they introduce Cable, which Josh Brolin as Cable is really cool. Surprisingly less part of the film than even I expected, considering it's such a big like point of contention throughout the entire process of making the movie that he was going to be in it. So it's very strange to me, you know, his lack of screen time in that way. And they did reshoots to add more of him in, which is just like, wow, how much was he not in the movie before? So I really enjoyed, you know, and again, they had to very much like not go into his whole backstory a lot too, you know, just because, I mean, that's very complicated, admittedly. So there's just a lot there. So I can't really blame them for that, but it makes me wonder, you know, how well of a character like he will be accepted by a lot of other people, you know. But anyways, Josh Brolin did a great job there, and I like the look of his future and stuff like that. You know, that was all very Terminator-esque, like it was supposed to be and stuff like that. They directly referenced that later. Anyways, what did you think of Cable and how that was all handled?
I liked it. I actually read an interview with Rob Liefeld, who's character creator for Deadpool and for Cable and comic books. And he was on set and he was talking about it. And he had kind of pointed out that when Cable was first introduced, that's about as much detail as you got on Cable when he first popped up in the comic books. He's from the future and he has some robot arms and he loves guns, right? And he's here to kill something, right? And that's what you got. And that's what we got, right? You know, we got a little bit more than that. We got some, probably what is almost a cliche kind of motivation, right? You know, like, he killed my wife and daughter, I'm here to kill him first, right? Like, that's kind of all you need, you know, for getting real. And that's very characteristic of that 90s comic book stuff, which Deadpool, Cable, X-Force is very 90s. They were kind of really okay with just laying it out there and just saying, hey, he's here from the future to shoot your face, get over it, you know. And that's what we got. I think Josh Brolin, to me, is perfect casting for this. I think it's more of a no-brainer to cast Josh Brolin as Cable than it was even for Thanos, right? He did a great job as Thanos, but he wasn't like, in my brain, that's the guy I'm going to choose for that. He's a no-brainer for Cable, and he does it really well. I felt like their mix on the practical and digital effects for him was exactly right. You know, they give, I feel like a fair amount of it had to have been practical, with just a little post-pro in digital, which is, it helps it feel more grounded, and it's cheaper, right? You know, so that's also great. And yeah, so I like the character a lot. I feel like it would almost be out of place to give him a more complicated motivation in a film where people's motivations and their characters are really kind of second. They're not super important in these Deadpool movies, right? We got to have enough motivation to where their actions on screen make sense. But like, most of the characters, especially like your secondary supporting characters, they're deliberately played as stereotypes who are here to like perform one function. Like the Colossus character, he is deliberately characterized as an insufferable Boy Scout, right? In both Deadpool 1 and Deadpool 2. He's not fleshed out as more complicated than that. And they do that on purpose. They do the same thing for Negasonic. They do the same thing for Yukio, right? You know, it's just like, this is Negasonic. She's a moody teenage girl. this is Yukio, her lesbian girlfriend. She's super cheery because Negasonic is super moody.
I love that whole element between those three. I don't know what it was. Like, there's just something like very funny about the whole like he was very like lighthearted and warm to her, and right. very like cold to Negasonic, right? And she was in some way like always very responsive to just her part in that, like,
yeah.
I don't know that relationship, that whole little part, like, it's very minimal, right? But right. like that always got a kick. I always got a kick out of that little
part. To me, it was adorable. And yeah, my wife Tori, she was just like, she loved Yukio from the start, right? Because Yukio is nice. And like, hi Wade, hi Yukio, and then like he just goes off and does what, you know, so like whenever she shows up, she says hi to him and he says hi back, and then they go on to do whatever they're doing. So like most of your characters in these Deadpool films, they're not deep. And part of the reason is because it would almost be taking itself too seriously to go deep on this when, like, that's not this kind of film. So I think it was totally appropriate to kind of just do Cable. He's from the future. He's going to kill this guy. I don't think that's a good idea. I got to stop him. Throughout this movie, you know, you said earlier that it kind of just feels like a set of scenes that were just sort of stapled together. And you kind of sometimes feels a little lost at times. And it kind of... I wish more effort would have gone into making this movie feel like a one whole movie. I got the feeling sometimes that it was like a TV show. I don't know if that's exactly right. It felt like it was kind of an anthology film. Kind of like that Batman Gotham Knights thing where they had different directors and animators do different... Yeah, yeah. That's what it kind of felt like to me. It felt inconsistent enough to where it felt like... Like each writer took a different section of the film, and they kind of just didn't have the time or the inclination to just make them work together to feel like the whole thing. It didn't really bug me, because this movie doesn't take itself that seriously, right? It'd be different if, I don't know, some Nicholas Sparks movie did that to you, right? You know, it's very self-serious, and if it's very self-serious, I'm going to take you seriously, right? But if the whole point of the movie is not, I'm here... for master level storytelling, right? You know, like, that's not why you go to Deadpool. And you're not going to get it, which it would have been nice to have had both. So no surprises. It doesn't really... To me, it didn't really deliver on... Maybe it's not a fair standard, but it didn't really deliver on the story points to me.
I mean, I kind of feel the same way. And maybe it's in some way a little bit my fault, right? But, like, I think this is kind of where we kind of get into a little bit of a strange topic for me as far as the movie goes from, like... So much of this movie seemed very much built up to the idea of, like, the X-Force, right? And it's just kind of strange in the fact that, like, I know maybe that was a little bit misguided on my thinking, too, just because X-Force is the next movie coming out, so it's not supposed to be an X-Force movie, but when you introduce Domino, Cable, stuff like that, like, there's a little bit in me that's like, okay, this has got to be somewhat of a team movie there, right? And they just kind of very much felt thrown in, so much to the point where literally a whole team is thrown in for the idea of one scene, you know, a gag scene. And don't get me wrong, there's some laughs to be had within that. Probably one of the best cameos I've ever seen in my entire life is Brad Pitt getting electrocuted as the Vanisher. You know, that's really awesome, and the story behind that is incredible, but it just felt a little short. I just felt a little shortchanged by that, you know. Like, if they were going to die, you know, I think I could understand that and appreciate that a little bit more if it was actually during like a battle, but instead it was directly related to a gag of just like, no, we are literally going to kill these people that we just spent a good 10 minutes setting up, right? Like, we literally spent like a good 10 minutes before this point only to have the rug pulled out from underneath us there. But the scene following it is great too. The whole, because you get to see, because like, kind of leading into this, like, Domino's great. Like, she's, dude, Zazie Beetz is amazing and one of the most beautiful human beings on this planet. And it's just like that whole idea, like, kind of like really explaining her powers in that visual way that they do in that very like Final Destination way. That was great, right? And so I'm glad that that directly followed that whole gag, just because at least you really get to see her shine. She's the standout kind of in every scene that she's in at that point. But yeah, like again, all that was just, that was kind of strange. But then you, I mean, it's followed by probably one of the strongest scenes in the entire movie to me, is that whole domino sequence, Cable showing up and they're having that fight on there. And then it directly leads into the Juggernaut reveal, right? Which is just like, that was crazy. Like I didn't expect that. And so like, it was like really worth it by that point. So yeah, like I'm fine with the final product that I have, right? Like it's not a bad movie. I really enjoy this movie. It's very funny. And there's some great reveals in there, like Juggernaut. And I like that, you know, he was just there to be that, kind of his Colossus is, right? Like Colossus is very much there to be the muscle. Juggernaut was there to be Russell's muscle. And they play on that and you use him very well, you know? And so that was cool. That was cool to see. And I really enjoyed that sequence in the movie. I thought it was very, very well done. And a huge part of the budget looks to go in that scene too.
Yeah. So yeah, yeah. I really kind of, I don't know, to me the whole using the X-Force and then killing him right off the bat, to me felt like a response to the spoiler culture and the fact that it's almost impossible to keep production details secret on this stuff. Like you and me, like we make a superhero podcast. Like we love superhero stuff. And we're kind of not the exact sort of person who clamors over plot details. Like we love casting details and we love like, you know, we're going to see this or we might see something like that, right? But as far as like, this cameraman saw this scene and this is crazy, you should totally hear about it. Like, you and I very much want to go see the movie, right? But like, there's this huge, and whether it's just like jerks who love to ruin the fun or what, I don't really get a whole, I don't understand the spoiler thing super well, right? I just know it exists and I know that it's a lot of work on these productions to keep stuff under wraps. There's just a lot of work and a lot of extra work that wouldn't be necessary, right? You know, you probably shaved $10 million off the budget in man hours and shuffling stuff back and forth if you didn't have to care about this stuff, right? And so I felt like someone got frustrated with everything they had to do. So they put it out there that, you know, we're doing X-Force with Terry Crews and, you know, everybody else. And they're going to have Shatterstar. And then, like, they have him jump off the plane and they kill them all off just, like, immediately. Just as kind of a finger to everybody who's like, you know, you thought this is what the movie was going to be about. And this is what we're telling you to just stop trying, right? Because we're just going to screw with you this entire time if you insist on dancing this dance. I totally understand the inclination to do that, right? I've definitely done, like, smaller versions of that in my own life, right? So I get it. But it felt like a lot of time to spend on a gag that wasn't super funny, right? Like, it would have been, I feel like if you would have killed one or two of them, and you just start shaving them off one by one, right? But to kill all of them pretty much as they fall off the plane, I feel like, I don't know, it would have been a tighter film if they just wouldn't have had the rest of that, right? Like, he does this interview with all these people, and he's like, she's the only one who I really want to have here, and you jump off from there. You know, you could change that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It felt like they were wasting my time with the whole,
again, it's not that it wasn't, you know, had its moments of laughs and stuff like that. Like, again, it kind of just felt like the X-Men's mansion sequence, right? It feels a little insignificant and it just kind of like adds to that whole idea of like, it probably could have been more, a little bit tighter of a film altogether, right? And so anyways, you know, that was great. Another thing in the movie that's probably one of my favorite out of the entire thing, and something I'm glad they actually like expanded upon for this one that I really think we need to talk about is Dopinder. His whole thorough line in the whole movie is like,
he's hilarious.
So awesome. Like, just everything that he said in the movie made me laugh.
Yes.
You know, and like I'm almost going to go back on my words just a little bit here. Like, okay. I think the introduction of the X-Force thing, just for that like interview section, Yes. Just for Dopinder's joke in there is almost worth the entire like waste of time that all of that was. Just because like the fact that he so badly wants to be a contract killer, wants to learn from Deadpool and stuff like that, right?
Right.
And like he always is like, what's your superpower? And he's just like so innocently like courage, you know, like just like the whole part was so endearing and like so funny. And then like the next scene almost directly after it, right? It's just like they let in a non-superhero person just because he saw the ad. And he's like, what the f-? Yeah, I was like, what the-? He has this little moment of freak out. Like, that, dude, like, I was, like, crying laughing during that part. Like, it's just, it's so funny. And then, like, when that, you know, they had, like, the same moment, basically, from the first movie of, like, when they're finally doing the slow-mo, like, kickoff scene into the fight, right? Of, like, the music kicks in. And just the fact that it finally pans out, you know, and Dopinder's like running alongside them too, like he's like speeding up to catch up to the team because he's like he's down, like, you know, like he's like, no matter what, I'm gonna be in this fight, you know. That was hilarious, you know, everything that Dopinder was in made the movie like that much funnier to me. So that was great. I absolutely love his little throw line there. And then of course he gets to basically kill the bad guy in the end, you know. And so he has his moment there. And it's interesting, you know, because like something that we'll probably talk about, maybe a question I'll pose later, but you know, he's there at the end of the film, kind of like part of this family, right? You know, so it was very satisfying in that way. And so I'm glad they were able to, I thought he felt one of the most organic things in the movie, right? Like the fact that he kept coming back because he's their driver and stuff like that. And so I thought he was a great character that like he was one of the few characters that actually didn't get put on the back burner. He actually got more screen time, you know, in this movie, because even like Colossus and Negasonic, they're like basically not in the movie at all except for the 2-3 scenes, if you want to count the first two scenes and then them being at the end, you know. So anyways, that was cool. And then I think we should probably talk a little bit about Russell. What did you think about his character? I love that kid. I don't know if you've seen it, but Taika Waititi, his film before Thor was where he was introduced. Hunt for the Wilder People. Amazing movie if you haven't seen it. Extremely funny. Also kind of endearing in that way that it's actually pretty, pulls at the heartstrings. It's a little bit more of like a drama. I don't want to say that. It's kind of a dramedy in some ways for Taika Waititi. But anyways, we're getting off topic there. His name's Julian Dennison. New Zealander. I thought he is very funny in real life and in his movies. And I thought his character, while admittedly could have been maybe like a little bit more, I don't know, it feels unfair to say, but he probably could have been like a deeper character in some ways. But at the same time, like, I thought his motivations made sense. His powers were pretty cool. And, you know, I think a little bit of a where they show him going, you know, with the fact that he's the one that eventually leads to killing Cable's family. And you can tell he's kind of a very powerful mutant by that point in the future. You know, I thought that all of that was done very well for his character and his interactions with other characters, Deadpool including, was very well done. And then just like little moments, like I love his moment at the end of the where it's kind of the big climax of the movie, right? Like they're having to like sit there and Deadpool's trying to save him. I love that moment though, where he walks out right after blowing them out the side of the building. And he's like, dang, it feels good to be a gangster. You know, he's like starting to get into himself a little bit there.
Yeah.
Building his confidence basically as a mutant because he's getting better at it and stuff like that as he gets more angry. I loved his character. And it's very, it's another question I think I'll pose later, but his character arc I think is strong, and I bought the relationship between him and Deadpool, and so he's a good point in the film. I just think that all that connection to him and Cable and stuff like that, all of that was in there, but it felt kind of like a different movie in some cases. Whenever it was with him sometimes, but anyways, that's a different kind of a different thing. But anyways, I really liked him, and I think he's a great actor. So I thought he, for what he was given, he did a pretty great job with the character. So what did you think? Have you seen his first, The Hunt for the Wilder People, at all?
I've seen trailers and stuff. I haven't actually put down the time to go see it.
Sure.
I know if it's anything like the rest of Taika's work, it's got to be phenomenal, right?
It's great, yeah.
And there's no way, like, because that's really his only other credit, right?
It is.
For the Wilder People.
Yeah.
So, like, he wouldn't have gotten chosen for this high-profile gig if he wasn't super great on that film. So, like,
oh, yeah. Yeah, he's a standout in that movie, because it's his movie, basically. But,
right.
Yeah, definitely check that out. But what did you think of the Russell character? Was it kind of what you were expecting? Were you surprised by it at all?
Yeah, I was kind of expecting, because this movie is not a subtle, the Deadpool series is not a subtle series. So I was expecting them to go to really overdo his characterization. I was glad that they didn't. He kind of had to walk a line between obnoxious enough that you can understand why someone might want to kill him, but not so obnoxious that you don't want to have him killed, right? You need to kind of be along with Deadpool on his mission in order for this movie to have, to keep you engaged, right? If you think that what he's doing is dumb and you're with Cable the entire time, you're like, nah, this dude's the worst. You need to kill him now, right? Like, then this movie becomes tedious and it becomes tough to work with, right? So you've got to be there. You got to agree that, you know, this kid's a hurt kid. He needs someone to take care of, you know, to take an interest in him, right? And, like, you see that all the way through this movie with his interactions with everybody. He's looking for somebody that he can kind of get under their wing, right? And I loved, actually, it lent a lot of depth to that character, the way that him and Juggernaut actually, like, talk back and forth about stuff, right? You know, they're walking up there, and the kid's kind of like psyching himself up while walking up, getting ready to set the whole place on fire. Like, I'm going to do this. And Juggernaut's like, yeah, that sounds great, right? And he's like, and then I'm going to go do this, and I'm going to kill that dude. And Juggernaut sounds like, dope, yeah, let's go, right? And like,
he's like, that's my middle name or whatever it was that he said, you know? Like, yeah.
And so Juggernaut is like down, right? You know, I think it would have been a little disappointing, or it wouldn't have been believable if Juggernaut just basically is like, hey, thanks, kid, and then like, flicks him and sends him off to the upper atmosphere, and he's like, get gone, right? Like, there's actually like a bit of a friendship there, which makes it believable that they would team up and they would start basically causing a lot of problems, to where it would have to be a big problem for Cable in the future, right? Because if it's kind of like a relationship that doesn't work, you're like, man, this kid's just getting it from all sides. Why would you stick around with that guy if he's just gonna yell at you the entire time, right? So I feel like there's more subtle points in the writing than are initially present. I feel like for me, there were three, I don't know how many writers there were on this film. I feel like there were three hypothetical writers, and one guy was really good with details, and another guy was really good with set pieces, and the other guy was just phoning it in. And so, like, depending on what they were given, you kind of have issues. But I like the character. I think the actor did his job by playing it really convincingly when this movie is not like a, it's a movie that plays on stereotypes and it doesn't have a whole lot of room for deep characters, and you could have used more, but he was interesting enough that I was interested to see him on screen instead of like Negasonic, who even like one of my favorite lines from her in Deadpool 1, when Deadpool is like, okay, so you're just a teenage girl and you're going to say something mean, and you're going to say, and you have sullen silence, and then you're going to say something mean just to have sullen silence later. So what is it now? Is it sullen silence or is it something mean? And she just like pops her bubble gum and she's like, you've got me in a box here, right? She just admits it like outright that's just who she is, right? So I see her on screen and she's fun when she blows stuff up, right? I also thought it was cool that they showed that she's obviously stronger in this film than she was in the last film, right? She's not training anymore. But I really wanted to see more of this kid, and I really kind of was invested in Deadpool giving to him. It needed work and it needed talent to make that feeling come across the screen.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, just because when you really sit there and think about it, like, their relationship has to be built in essentially like one scene, you know, one to two. Like, it's really like a collection of like three short scenes. You know, his introduction at the Essex when he shows up to the situation. They get arrested together, so they basically have their like scene and their introduction to the prison, their lunch scene, and then their, you know, basically like breaking out scene. You know, so it's like a very quick culmination of like scenes there that they have to very much establish like somewhat of a relationship, and they kind of like revisit that, you know, just barely throughout. They don't, Deadpool and him aren't really together that often outside of that first little scene, the prison scenes, basically, you know. So they establish a somewhat of rapport, I guess you could say, as characters, pretty quickly, and it's something they have to buy very quickly as well, and I think they sell that. So that was an interesting point there. But yeah, and the third act is very strong, and I think that's where the movie succeeds. You know, it kind of lands on its feet there, right? Whether you like how it got there or weren't as bought in or whatever, I think a lot of people can agree that the ending, I think, is pretty strong, just because you have that whole idea that he does sacrifice himself, essentially saving Russell, kind of inspires Cable in that way too, right? You know, it saves, it does the same thing that Cable was trying to do, by saving his family while also saving the kid at the same time. So Deadpool's the hero in that moment, and Cable recognizes that. And but that whole end scene with Vanessa, right, is like the big moment, and that ridiculously amazing rendition of "Take on Me" by A-ha. That's like so heartbreaking, and it's on, like, it's in its own way. Like, that was very villainous of them. I hate them, but it was great. Yeah, and so I thought that all of that was done pretty beautifully. Like, again, like, it was that heartbeat of the movie that I wasn't expecting, but I'm glad it was there because it helps tie that movie and a good bow, you know, for me. And so then the way Cable used, of course, you know, you kind of see it coming, but of course Cable's going to save him, use what his last little burst of time travel that he has to save Deadpool instead of going back to his family like he could have, setting up, you know, the future for X-Force. And they still accomplish the same thing. He just is able to save Deadpool's life this time around. And so, yeah, I thought that was all done very well. And I felt like a lot of the reshoots for Domino was at the end there too, just because like she wasn't in the big fight really at the end, right? Like she was having to do her thing inside, saving the kids, and I was like that feels reshot to me. Yeah, so anyways, maybe that's, then she's like there at the end with them dying and stuff, yeah, like that.
Let's talk a little bit more about Domino, because I really thought that character worked a lot better than I necessarily thought it was going to.
I wasn't sure where she was going to fit in, right? And so that's kind of where that whole X-Force thing, again, is whether I'm not completely sold on it. Like, again, it was necessary in that way to introduce her, just because how else was she going to get into the story? Yeah, she's so great. And, you know, they kind of provide a little bit of backstory with her when she shows up there, saying that this is kind of where she had to grow up to. So she kind of reveals a little bit of a tragic backstory in her own way there, that she was tortured here too. So she kind of feels that need to be in the fight at that point as well. And then she saves the kids, once again using her lady luck, as she calls it, her luck, her powers that are completely consistent of luck. Just destroying fools, you know. It looks like people are killing themselves at points, you know, and great, yeah, great stuff. And then of course she's like, you know, I'm gonna need a bus to get you all out of here, and then a bus, you know, comes crashing into the building. I'm like, oh great, right this way, orphans, you know. Yeah, I thought Zazie did a great job of just being kind of joyous, you know, in her character. Like, she's like, when you think about it, she's just not in it that much, but she just has that presence about her that it's like, man, I want to see more of this chick, you know. Her guns are cool. Like, I love the design of her guns. Yeah, and so I'm glad, obviously, that she's what was Oh, I love the point. One of the best parts there at the end of the highway, the convoy sequence, you know, is like immediately like Deadpool's just like, Doms, I need you. Use my arms as backpack straps.
Yeah. That's exactly what she does, right?
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah, like that whole scene was hilarious. But yeah, again, they did a really good job of like kind of using the visual storytelling to explain like what kind of a superpower she has. And her look is great, right? Like it's so different from the comics, but it completely works on screen. And like, yeah, you just, there's something about it, right? Like you just kind of fall in love with that character, even though there's just not much to really reflect on other than just her, the stuff that she got to do. But I can't wait to see more. Like, I hope she's a huge part. I hope she's a huge part for X-Force, for sure.
Well, and part of what made that character so great was the way it was acted, right? You know, Zazie is a fantastic actress. Yeah. But I made the observation walking out of the theater that part of why I love that character so much was because she acted exactly like somebody whose superpower was that she's lucky. She's nonchalant about literally everything, right?
Yeah. Like it almost came off as kind of cocky in that way.
Yeah, because it'll work out, right? She just doesn't have to worry about anything.
I think you're just kind of attracted to the confidence that she has, right? Like, she's like, no, I'm pretty sure this is going to work out for me. Yeah.
Right.
I just love the way she played it. Like you said, it very nonchalant, but she had that confidence about her. Like, nah, like, I'm here for a reason.
Yeah.
So.
Or even like, with her character introduction, he's like, what's your superpower? I'm lucky. That's not a superpower. Yeah, it is. No, it's not. Yeah, it is, right? And she's just, nothing about her. She never really seemed stressed out. She never really seemed scared, right? She's just, it really communicated to me, like, this is a person who's been going through her entire life, being like, pianos falling out of the sky and missing her by inches, and she just, that's just how she expects to go through life, right?
Yeah.
And like,
and then, like, just her, like, I love her little nuance, like, there's something just nuanced about the performance, but, like, I love her little moment, like, okay, when they go to get Colossus, right, and he's holding up the little speaker box.
Right.
Like, what exactly does Domino do in this scene, you know? Like, Cable's not even hardly in it at all. Like, they don't, like, I'm not even convinced that Josh Brolin was on the set that day. but the only person you see is Deadpool and her outside of the car. And, like, I don't know. Like, there's something about her just, like, leaning outside of the window, just, like, crossing arms and putting her head down. Like, oh, we're just here trying to get Colossus. Like, I don't really understand why we're here, but I'm just going to watch. Like, I don't know. There's just something about the whole thing that I'm just like, man, she's adorable. And she could kill you at the same time. And, like, I don't know. There's just something about it. But maybe I'm just biased. I don't know. But, yeah. Great stuff. She's a superstar, and everybody's gonna know that very soon. So
yeah,
if they don't,
and already. Like this is part of what frustrates me about this movie. I'm ready for final thoughts. If you are,
yeah, let's get into it.
That's what's frustrating to me about this movie is that it has bright shining moments surrounded by mediocrity. Right, we have the highway scene, which is beautiful. It's well paced. It's well directed.
Fun, super fun. Has reveals. Yeah.
Right. Everybody ate their Wheaties before storyboarding that particular scene, right? And then, like, we have moments where 10 minutes before, 10 minutes after, it feels phoned in, right? And it feels like, it gave me the impression of this, like a paper that you worked really hard on it, but you didn't give yourself enough time to do it well. And, like, you turn in this paper that has, like, a really great paragraph and, like, some other really good ideas. And then, like, the rest is just filler. And that bums me out. Because if I could have had a whole movie of everyone doing top flight whatever, this would have been a fantastic movie. But I found the movie very entertaining, and I enjoyed my time. I didn't feel like I wasted my money. I felt like it was a good follow-up, and I'm ready to go see X-Force, right? That's where I'm at. But, like, I feel like Thor talking to Loki, right? You'll always be the god of mischief, but you could be so much more. And I don't understand how that happened. And I wasn't on set, so I'll never know. Right, but I don't know what the deal is here, and it leaves me confused.
Yeah, I'll agree with you. I enjoyed my time very much. I recommend people go see it because I think it's hilarious. We didn't even talk about probably one of the best gags in the movie with the baby legs and stuff like that, right? Like you know what I'm saying? Like, there's so many, like, again, like, those high moments in the movie that hit really hard, and then there's just other moments that just kind of just fall flat. I'm just like, oof. Like, watch it the second time. Like, I found the second time more enjoyable seeing it just because I was able to, like, look forward to some of those things that were coming, I think, you know? But, like, it is one of those things where it's like, I wish there could just be, like, things that you could just, like, cut out of the movie and, like, somehow, like, make it a little bit more cohesive and work faster. But, yeah, at the end of the day, like, Ryan Reynolds is great as Deadpool. He is Deadpool. They do a good job of introducing new characters that are going to be essential to X-Force in that way, right? But at the same time, some of these things feel very inconsequential. Another thing I didn't mention was, I think while the third act, as far as emotionally goes, sticks the landing really well, like, the whole fight literally leading up to that feels very, again, like, it felt kind of weightless. You know, like, Colossus is literally there to beat up Juggernaut, and just, like, that whole fight between them just felt kind of like air. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's, I don't know, there just wasn't, like, they even make a joke about it, right? Like, oh, big CGI fight coming in. And it's kind of just how it felt, right? Like, it kind of felt like Justice League fighting Darkseid at the end of, you know, at the end of Justice League. Like, I knew who was going to win, you know? I just, it didn't feel any, it didn't have that punch that you had when Deadpool was there to save Vanessa, you know, at the end of the first one. Like, it just wasn't there for me. But anyways, and that's just kind of how that's kind of just sums up the idea of the movie, right? Like, there's something there that doesn't feel so right. Then there's something right that follows right after that feels really good. Right. And it just kind of feels like a domino effect of that. So it kind of leaves a weird feeling coming out of the movie. It's very funny. And I think for a lot of people, especially not invested maybe as much as superhero characters as we are, it's not going to be a big deal. That's Deadpool 2, right? And they're filming X-Force by the end of the year. And they have just an absolutely fantastic team behind that. So let's hope that they can really pull through on that end, right? Let's talk about just a quick thing at the end here. So it's been confirmed now that the movie's come out. So Deadpool and the post-credit scene gets the time machine fixed for Cable, right? He goes back and cleans up the timelines, as he says, right? So very funny. It's very, like, that's hilarious, absolutely hilarious credit scene. Like, it's a great, great way to end the movie. However, something that is kind of also strange about it is that he goes and he saves Vanessa, right? Like, after this very, like, heartfelt moment of, like, she's gonna be there, like, but he's not where he needs to be right now, right? So immediately after that, he goes and he saves Vanessa with the time machine, and it's been confirmed that she is now alive again. Like, he did that, she's alive, good to go, you know? So it begs the question to me, like, and the writers say it, you know, they're like, we kind of, like, it's an interesting thing because we kind of just completely swept the movie that we just made under the rug in that moment. And the fact that, like, when you really think about it, is like, okay, so by doing that, is Cable's family now probably dead again? Because essentially, like, why would he need to save Russell, anything like that, you know what I'm saying? Like, it just leaves all of that in a very interesting place for me. And I literally, the writers have said in the interview, like, we're kind of just hoping that people don't dwell on it too much and that they're just willing to accept it because it's Deadpool. And I'm just like, if that's how you want to do it, like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I'm willing to meet the writers there. I'm never going to say that I think it's great, right? You know, like if the writers are telling me not to take this seriously,
mm-hmm.
then okay, cool, yeah. But like it still bums me out because honestly,
it kind of does me too, right? Because like then it feels like when we get to X-Force, there's a little bit of like an answer there. Like you kind of have to like. I don't know. It feels like it feels like Thor and Jane Foster when Thor meets up with the Avengers, right? Like they kind of have to explain why Jane Foster's not part of the process in the Avengers at that point. And they have to do the same thing in Age of Ultron, right? So it just feels a little strange that now they're going to potentially have to do that for X-Force 2. Like why is Deadpool not caring about maybe getting home so much? Like why is he content with being a part of this team instead of being with Vanessa that they've just like I think it would have just honestly been better, you know, to leave her dead. And I love that character, so it's hard to, like, that's also hard to say in some ways, but, like, at least, you know, you don't have to go through a bunch of that. Unless Vanessa ends up being, like, some big character that I don't even expect, you know, in X-Force, but I just don't see that. Anyways, I don't know.
There's some possibility there. The character of Vanessa Carlyle is actually a mutant in the comic books.
She is. She's a mutant named Copycat. She's a shapeshifter. Yeah. But
she's basically Mystique, right?
Yeah, so in some way, yeah.
And like I could see it. To me, I would pull this up as a case study in film school, and I would show it to people. Like when the mass market says what it wants is a happy ending. You shouldn't always give it to them because it does really kind of screw with the whole thing here. Right. And maybe I like to be generous with the writers. I like to basically say, hey, I love to be surprised. Right. I would love to see this work better than I think it should. Right. You know, I'd love to see something this, something that. Right. And I can kind of see, I could see it becoming a running gag where Deadpool doesn't take anything seriously like anyone else because he has a time machine no one knows about, right? Or, you know, whatever. It really just leaves me grasping for straws thinking about, like, because let's be real, they didn't plan this out, right? Like, they just said that. Like, originally they were going to keep it that way. And then the writer's like, yeah, but we wanted to give a happy ending for Deadpool. And so they just, like, made a decision on, like, an afternoon after a couple Long Island iced teas. They're just like, you know what? Wade deserves a happy ending, right? And so what they did was they screwed themselves is what they did, right? And here it is on film. So, like, there's only really two things they can do. They can basically say that Wade screwed up the timeline so much with all of his fixing, right? And so Cable actually has to go to the point in the timeline where Negasonic is about to hand off the fixed time machine to Wade, and he's seen the consequences, so he grabs it and he crushes it. Like, we're not doing that, right? And then you just erase the post-credit scene. And I felt like it would have actually worked better, like you know, playing armchair quarterback, right? You know, if you would have ended that little post-credit thing where Wade goes and screws with all kinds of stuff, because that's who he is, and then eventually you get to Cable, who's like, no, that's not a good idea, and he just undoes all that stuff, and it's like a comical montage. I think that fits the character of the movie perfectly, right? But no, I didn't like it. I think it really pulled a lot of the air out of the character, and it really kind of it felt like a move to deepen the whole character and the whole series by killing her and leaving her dead, right? And she's been, like, the motivation for this whole deal. And what he's forced to do is kind of forced to do his thing until it's his time to go. Right? You know?
Right. I thought that worked really well. I did, too. Like, that was kind of, like, the moral of the story, right? And, like, that's what he even says. Is, like, this is supposed to be a family film. And that's literally his arc in the movie is being able to find a family without Vanessa there, right? Like, it's his recovery from her death. So then it's just, again, and the post-credit scene is extremely, extremely funny. And so at the end of the day, when you're really sitting there, like, you don't care in that moment, but then you sit there and think about what exactly that means. And it's just like, it's weird, you know? Like, it's just really strange. And, yeah, how they approach it going forward is a big concern, I think, for me. So, anyways, I just wanted to bring that up because I think it's just an interesting topic that's come up after the release. So,
yeah. No, yeah. I wish they didn't do it. But, you know, it's not my movie. Me too. So.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Cool. All right. Well, that's Deadpool 2. I think we both are kind of saying, it seems weird because it seems like, it seems like we've been almost bashing on the movie a little bit, but I think we're both saying
we're hard on it because we love it, right? We
yeah, exactly. Exactly, and it's funny. Go see it, all that stuff. So, tell us what you think, right? Like, we want to hear what you think about it. You know, mm-hmm. Tell us why we were right. Tell us why we were wrong. We're very active on Twitter, so you can find us both there at Space Eraser for Sam, at Cambos for me.
I actually changed my Twitter name.
Did you really?
Yeah, it's at HC_Sam.
See, this is why you don't listen to me, folks. This is why I'm going to hand it off to Sam for the rest of this outro. Sam, take us out of this place.
This has been the Hero Cafe. Next week, we're going to do our retrospective on Black Panther. You guys don't know it, but we recorded two episodes on Black Panther that both got sent to the garbage heap because of technical difficulties. So we're going to do our Black Panther thing, and we're going to bring a lot of those ideas, and we're going to have a lot more perspective, so we'll be able to talk a little more objectively because we were geeking out hardcore. I still love that movie. Yeah. But that's amazing. What the retrospective is all about, right? It's about getting a little more space and getting a little more objective.
Yep, for sure. Cool beans.
So with that, I have been Sam Drake.
And I'm Cameron Bowes.
And we'll catch you on the flip-flop. Don't forget to give maximum effort.
Peace.
Deuces.